Good morning. Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this morning's roundtable. This is actually, if I counted right, and David Rubin can correct me if he knows better, this is the 8th appearance of the Ivory Tower panel at TMR, so we're really pleased to have them here. I just want to remind you that we will be back next week with another program. We're going to be talking about public art and issues surrounding art and development and culture in the city. So that's very important, and I hope you'll be here then before we take a break of 1 week for Thanksgiving, of course. So, because we do have a lot to talk about, I'm not going to say much more, except that I'm really disappointed. Not in you, but in all the registered voters of Onondaga County who didn't show up at the polls on Tuesday. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Maybe we'll hear more. But, all right. Well, I'm going to turn it over. Today we have as our moderator Barbara Kroll Foat. Barbara is a professor of communications, broadcast, and digital media at Syracuse University at the Newhouse School. And she's also the founding director of the Tully Center for Free Speech there. And maybe sometime we should get her here and have her talk about that, because she gives a very interesting talk. But I'm going to let Barbara say hello and then have the panelists introduce themselves.
Good. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. Even though the panel's been here 8 times, this is my first time. And I know from the buzz on email that the panel really enjoys coming to be with you. And it's nice to see faces instead of cameras out there that we can interact with personally. If I don't look real familiar, I'm the substitute host. When David Rubin at the other end of the panel isn't there, I am moderating. And just to tell you a little secret, David really likes it every once in a while when there's not enough people on the panel, so he has to go on the panel, because then he can talk more. So having already introduced him, let me start with David and have each of the panelists say who you are and what institution you represent.
Well, I think you all know who I am. I'm Dean Emeritus of the Newhouse School at Syracuse, usual moderator of Ivory Tower, occasional columnist for the Syracuse Post-Standard, and now a regular member of the faculty at Newhouse teaching First Amendment law and the freshman required introductory course on the media in America.
I'm Lisa Dolak, and I'm a professor of law at the Syracuse University College of Law.
I'm Bob Green. I'm a professor of history at Casanova College.
I'm Tara Ross, professor of history at OCC.
I'm Bob Spitzer. I'm in the political science department at SUNY Cortland.
And if you watch us on Friday nights, we have two other panelists, Tim Burns from Colgate University and Christy Anderson from Syracuse University. Well, tonight we want to, that's my usual line, tonight. See, I don't have a teleprompter. This morning, we heard you like politics. So we're going to talk politics, local politics, and some national politics, and do our usual A's and F's, and we open the grade book and give an A or an F to somebody or something in the news. And then we're going to leave a good 30 minutes because we're really eager for interacting with you and some of your questions. The panel, I want to start out with some analysis of the local election. Here in Onondaga County, the Republicans had the majority, and when they redistrict and downsize, it's no surprise that Tuesday the Republicans gained what looks like a 13-4 majority, and the county exec is Republican, so we have a very Republican county. In the city, the Democrats outweigh the Republicans in the registration, so we have probably an all-Democratic common council, an all-Democratic probably school board, and the mayor's a Democrat. So we really have this concentration of one party more than another. And Tara, I'm wondering, what does this say to you about the health of a two-party system or whether these kind of supermajorities are good for governing?
Well, in terms of the health of the two-party system, I think it actually proves that the two-party system is doing well because you do, in a sense, have sort of an interesting variety of individuals winning elections. I also think it really spoke well that Howie Hawkins did as well as he did. And I really wonder for him if the real issue is that because he's in the Green Party, people sort of assume the Green Party is not electable. And so that's why he's not winning elections, because in a very real sense, he has sort of become, you know, sort of a career politician now. And so he has a following. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. He has a following. And I really do think if he was in either of the other two parties, he would have been elected by now. So I think what's really, in a sense, hurting him is the fact, the identification with the Green Party. But I do think it speaks well for the system that he did so well. And we very well could see in sort of the next election cycle him actually achieving a position.
Well, if you run for public office 100 times, perhaps you'll be elected once.
Well, you know, it only takes once to get the ball rolling. It's okay.
You've talked about the two parties. Let me add the Tea Party for a moment. If you're looking at the Tea Party talking particularly about the economy and scaling back, you're not going to find an awful lot to love in this election. Look at Camillus. Camillus had the opportunity to scale down their government, make it cheaper, and they virtually unanimously chose the most expensive option to keep the village and elect a mayor who agreed with that. If you're looking to find portents for the future and what's going to happen in 2012, and there was another one that we were talking about when we were warming up as well. The town of Salina. The town of Salina did the same thing. When we're given an opportunity to cut back, we don't seem to want to take it. That's the best I can do for the moment.
Back to the issue
of
the
better
city.
Than usual.
You know, I got on this morning and I'm prepping and I'm saying, I got to find something interesting in these elections. To hell with it. I'll take the first thing I get because this was the most boring election that I can possibly remember. So that's the best that I can do.
Lisa, certainly on paper, anyway, what Barbara described is very dramatic in terms of the Republican having such control in the county government and the Democrats having total control in the state or in the city government. And I think that ordinarily would be of concern to me, but I think for a couple of reasons it's less of a concern. One is the as Barbara and I were discussing before we started to talk, the cooperation and the collaboration that has gone on between the heads of county and city government, for one thing, but that obviously may not, you know, who knows how long that will last, and both in terms of whether they will continue to work together the way they have, and whether they will both stay in office, and whether the majorities in the legislative bodies will outlast their tenure. But it's also the fact that these kinds of party dominance, I think, matter a lot less on the local level than they would on the state or the federal level. So I'm less concerned about it in the sense that it's the local government, and all Republicans locally don't look alike, and all Democrats don't look alike, and that you can't say that to as great of an extent, certainly at the state and federal levels.
I wonder if actually usually the tension is between the executive and the legislature, and I wonder... usually the tension is between the Democrats and the Republicans, the two parties, and I wonder here if the tension is going to be more between the executive and the legislature, because Stephanie Miner has had some issues with the Common Council. Joni Mahoney, you all read the paper this morning about the veto-proof majority the Republicans have, so that may be where the tension and perhaps checks and balances, I don't know, comes.
That's an interesting point, because it is a different kind of schism, and it is one that often appears, but I will add that the job of political parties is to provide voters with a choice. I mean, that's why parties exist. That's why political parties are considered synonymous with a democratic system. I point out to my students that nations like North Korea have elections. Cuba under Castro has elections. Communist nations have elections. They have very high turnout. What's the difference between those nations that have election and ours? And the difference is that voters don't have a choice in those nations in those elections. And it's the job of political parties to provide an opposition. Now, it's understandable at the local, you can see why it is that in local areas where one party tends to dominate, the other party sort of atrophies, but it is a failure of the parties to provide opposition. That's their job. Voters are supposed to have a choice, and it does encourage complacency and power consolidation in a way that's not really healthy for democracy when that does not occur.
Let me make two observations. One is I was most struck by the 26% turnout in Onondaga County. That indicates apparently the lowest in history. That strikes me as a sign that the current system is simply broken. I mean, let's not kid each other. So what are you going to do about this? My fellow panelists would probably say, well, we need better candidates and stronger issues and so on. I don't think we have time to fool around with that. It's not going to work. I don't know how many of you saw in the New York Times last Sunday the recommendation from William Galston of the Brookings Institution. But he pointed to Australia and 31 countries around the world where, like jury duty, which is mandatory, that voting should be mandatory. And in Australia, where it is, 95% of the public votes. And you can enforce this either through moral suasion, where it becomes so clear that this is one of the responsibilities of being a citizen in a free country, you vote, or you can fine people. And there are countries where the fine is like paying for a traffic ticket. This would do many good things. If we had 95% turnout, the ability of the extremists on both the left and the right in this country to control elections goes away, because they don't have enough votes any longer to win. It means that the parties would not have to spend money on getting out the vote. The vote will have to come out, so they'll save all of that money. They won't have to spend money on negative advertising to suppress the vote of their opponents, because you can't suppress the vote, because they're going to come out. So this means that you wouldn't have to raise as much money in order to run, which means that we might get more people who would be willing to run. And there would be less pandering to the base in advertising, because the base is not going to be enough to get you elected. Everything about this strikes me as good. It will have to begin in the United States as individual state experiments, given the craziness surrounding Obama's mandate that people must buy health insurance, the notion that the federal government would mandate that everybody has to vote. I can already hear the debate. But but if it's framed around this is a civic responsibility and a duty, and if the public relations is done properly, and if a state like New York, which I can see might embrace this, proves that it can work, then I think it would transform our politics tremendously. The other point I want to make was about the re-election of Rose Marie Belforti, who is the clerk in Ledyard who doesn't want to marry same-sex couples. We've heard enough about her, but the quote that got my attention was this one. Quote, this is from one of her supporters. I think she's done a good job. I'm not particularly interested in the politics of homosexuality. The state law is not the law in my Episcopal parish. So I read that and I'm thinking, okay, suppose I was reading on the international page and that quote was made by a Shiite or a Sunni in Afghanistan or Pakistan who is saying that we have our religious law and those people in the central government, Karzai has his law, but we don't pay any attention to that. Everybody in this room would read that and think, this is ridiculous. You can't run a country that way. Don't they understand that the law of the country must supersede individual religious law? You know, why are we there to begin with trying to defend these people? And then you get this. And you have people saying this, which is, in my view, absolutely no different from the same mindset that has brought you Afghanistan, Pakistan, and most of the troubles in the Middle East. Those are my observations on this sad election.
Let me go back to his first point. I saw Bob and Lisa both make faces about this required voting.
Yeah, you make a very persuasive, thoughtful, and cogent case for the Australian ballot. It's just a shame that you're wrong. I guess I come at it from a different. I come at voter turnout from a different point of view. It's never concerned me. I'm certainly 26% turnout in Onondaga County is disappointing. Where I come at it, though, is trying to make people vote and persuading them to vote or fining them if they don't vote, if they don't know anything about the election, if they haven't read anything, if they haven't even bothered to know who the candidates are. So what are we going to do? Fine everybody? They go in and they just go straight party voting. We get 96% of voter turnout, and 75% of the people don't even know who the candidates are.
It turns people out.
You're right. It turns people out.
If they know that they're going to vote, then maybe they will pay attention. If they know they have to vote, they'll pay attention.
So finding them is automatically going to mean that they read a newspaper and follow the issues? No, I don't follow your logic. And I have not followed the logic of the Australian ballot. You're right. It does, and you're absolutely correct. It does increase voter turnout in the 31 countries that you talk about. Actually, I think it's more than that. I think the bigger issue is informing the electorate, and I would rather have 40% turnout who actually know who they're voting for.
David, whatever happened to the First Amendment?
What, you're worried about compelled speech?
A little.
Well, we permit some compelled speech. Look what the government does to the tobacco companies. Clearly compelled speech. They do it to all kinds of businesses where they want to dealing with commercial speech.
Yeah, you're talking about compelled political speech.
If you want to define a single vote
as
political
speech, how is this compelled?
Unless I'm allowed to show up and not vote,
right?
Then I'm being compelled to speak. Australia doesn't have a First Amendment.
Well, they share our tradition. They may
not
have a written First Amendment,
there are many judicial decisions where Australia that have serious impact on free speech concerns. They don't have a free speech. They don't have a First Amendment in.
The government is not telling you what to say. They're just asking you to say something. This is content
neutral.
That
is compelled speech.
This is content neutral. The government
is
not telling.
If I have to vote for a particular candidate, there's nothing content neutral about that.
You don't have
absolutely
to.
Absolutely violates the First Amendment,
I am shocked and appalled
that you, of all people, if Tim Burns were here, he would have dropped dead by now.
Yeah. Well, then I'll try it out again.
He'll try it out again tomorrow morning.
But listen, when I went to vote, I was in the 26%, and when I saw that in Manlius there were no Democratic candidates at all running for the town board, I didn't vote. All right, so that's not compelled speech. I vote. I went into the booth. The government's not telling me
right.
I had to vote for these people.
You're just I'm going to find them if they don't show up.
As long as I don't have to vote once I get there.
If you want to show up at the polls, go in there and then not vote for anybody. If that's your strategy, fine. Go ahead and do it.
I suspect the whole regime would be struck down very handily.
So we have 96% of the populace showing up, and we still got the same outcome because only 26% of the people are going to know what's going on.
Let me ask Bob Pritzker to highlight one more local election before we move to the nationals, and that's what happened in Dryden. I think it's interesting.
Some of you may know Dryden is a town that's halfway between Cortland and Ithaca on the border of Tompkins County, and there was a very heated set of local elections in Dryden that was based on the issue of hydrofracking, because Dryden officials have moved ahead to try and restrict or ban hydrofracking in their community. And it really was a referendum on that issue, very important issue. And those who oppose hydrofracking decisively won in Dryden. So in terms of that vote, it was a pretty clear referendum on that issue. And National Public Radio did a piece based in Dryden within the last week. I can't remember exactly what day it was. And it's just kind of interesting because, A, it was an issue-based election. B, it's an issue that has great consequences for us in central New York and Pennsylvania. So that was an interesting result, I thought.
Let's move to the national elections. And I'm interested in what trends or concerns or progress you see in elections around the country on Tuesday. And Bob Green, you want to talk about Ohio, I think.
Yeah, the landslide defeat of the referendum of that state law that had been spearheaded by Governor Kasich that curbed collective bargaining rights of public officials and went down to a resounding slamming defeat. Pundits right now are treating that as a window into the 2012 elections, because what they did in Ohio was they concentrated on this and they forgot about the economy. They forgot about job creation. And the analysis of the breakdown of the of that election said that there was a lot of 55-plus white males who Obama has had trouble with in the past, who went against this and started and gave as the reason in exit polls that they were upset that the election didn't turn around the economy and job creation. And so the Democrats are just sitting there saying, we know how to get to the people in this swing state right now. Obama is going to have a great deal of difficulty, and it will be impossible for a Republican candidate to win without Ohio, and Obama will have difficulty without it. And so if you look at this in terms of a national trend, I think it's just one more statement that anyone who wants to win in the fall has to put a great big sign in their office that says, it's the economy, stupid. And they have to focus on job creation and not take detours, if you will, like Kasich tried to do. It'll just drag them down.
The other thing that this really said about sort of the national trend is that I think what you're also seeing are workers really sort of pushing back on this notion that the problem with the economy is them, that, you know, bad work policies, bad union contracts, it's all about them. It's not about government policy. It's not about business decisions. It's all about the worker. And I really think that was part of what was being said in Ohio is, no, it's at best it's all of us, but it certainly isn't only us. It isn't only the worker.
Well, Ohio is notable because of one thing, mobilization.
Right.
The Democrats are very concerned about their ability to mobilize their base for the election next year because you don't get votes from people who stay home. I mean, the tail of the tape to a great degree is, you know, can you get your people out? Can you motivate them to get out? And there's been some disenchantment with Obama and the Democrats among the Democratic base, but they indeed were able to mobilize their voters in Ohio, and that the Obama administration has taken that as a positive sign for them that they may well, that Ohio may well be in play for them. They weren't thinking that it was, I think, before Tuesday, and that's kind of interesting.
The Republicans certainly overreached, though, on that ballot initiative. The polling showed tremendous support for one aspect of it, which was to have public workers contribute 15% to the cost of their health care.
An economic issue.
I think that had the initiative been confined to something like that, it might have been. It was the collective bargaining, taking that away, that bothered people. Not the notion that public employees should have to contribute to at least something approaching the extent that private employees have to contribute to their health care and other benefits.
Two thoughts. First, back on our other battle. Of all the people on this panel over the years, the one who is most concerned about what are the responsibilities of being a citizen as opposed to my rights, I deserve this, I deserve that. You're constantly weighing in on how about what we owe to the country. So now you're bailing out on me on this, on the responsibility to vote. This is totally inconsistent by you.
Well,
I just want to point that out. Okay?
Okay, and your position is totally inconsistent with the First Amendment, which wraps around the building that you personally are responsible for existing in this city.
No, because we're adding speech to the marketplace of ideas. We're not subtracting it.
But you're paying them to vote.
I just want to... No one's paying them. I just want to... point out one thing you may have missed in Arizona, which was surprising, which is the president of the Senate in Arizona, a guy named Russell Pierce, lost his seat. And he was the one who spearheaded Arizona's controversial anti-immigration bill and had also been challenging federal authority in getting involved in state matters in Arizona. This apparently shocked everybody, including Mr. Pierce, that he lost. I see that as a sign that the Republicans have overreached in their legislation in Ohio. That's how I see the vote in Ohio, in Arizona, in Mississippi with the abortion bill, that the Republicans have a lot of good issues in relation to pension costs and health care costs for public employees, but rather than try to solve those problems rationally, they rode them ideologically off the cliff. And that's what happened in Arizona. That's how I see what happened there. And if the Republicans don't basically look in the mirror and realize how far they can take the American people, they're in big trouble in the future.
Some Republicans, although this gentleman was replaced by another Republican.
Yes, but he was not in favor of the
immigration. No, right. That's
my point.
I'm
not opposed to Republicans. I like Republicans who are sane.
Why, thank you, David. Last thing I want to pick up on the Mississippi personhood, and I wanted to ask Tara what you saw coming out of that decision, because that got a lot of attention nationally.
Well, the Mississippi decision definitely was a case of the Republicans overreaching. This was a piece of legislation that had they simply stopped with the component that was simply on abortion, it very well might have passed. But the fact that they weren't willing to put in protections for women who were victims of rape, incest, the issue about women's health and the need for an abortion, the fact that if you had a miscarriage and there seemed to be any question about it, you might be subject to a criminal investigation. All of those things really made it almost impossible for even people who were pro-life to actually support this piece of legislation. So this was really a horrible case of overreaching. But now what will be interesting is to see if members of the Mississippi legislature who have indicated that what they might do is basically dismantle the legislation and then put it back through in pieces to see if any of those component pieces pass. That's what we'll need to look for.
Okay.
Could I mention before we move on
Yeah.
the two examples? There have been examples. The theme that I've seen come out in terms of analysis after the election has been not so much Republicans have overreached, but that the voters have said to, as a general matter, be reasonable to both sides. And an example, the examples that are being cited in terms of Democrat overreach, for example, or that for once a tax increase actually failed in the city of Seattle, which is virtually unheard of happening. And that had to do with a fee that would have been added to vehicle registration that would have made the cost of an average vehicle registration about $130, and people apparently just were not into paying three figures to register their vehicles. And the proceeds would have gone to, you know, something that I think certainly I and many people in this room and lots of people in Seattle would have supported, which would have been to improving access for bicycles in the city. But I think it was a bridge too far in terms of just one more tax increase. Plus, there was, and this is important, I think some concern, some indications that the public did not trust that the government would actually do with this money what the government was saying it was going to do with this money.
That's a good point.
And I think that is an underlying current that is not getting enough attention in terms of when people oppose tax increases, it's not always just because they're selfish or because they want to starve the government. It's because there is a breakdown in the trust that we have in terms of our government, again, doing with our money what the government should be or even says it's going to do with our money.
We're going to take a look a year hence and talk a little bit about what we might be talking about a year from now. And Bob Spitzer was in Cortland and made some bold predictions, I understand, last week for what you think is going to happen in the presidential election. So I want you to share what you shared and then get reaction from the rest.
Well, okay, I give election year talks. I've already given this talk several times in my area, and this actually is a 45-minute talk. And
please don't do that.
I'm ready to go now. But and I began it by citing my predictions of what the outcome I thought would be, and what I said was this. I think Mitt Romney will be the Republican nominee. I think Barack Obama will be reelected, but it will be by a narrow margin. Other indicators would suggest this would be a year where Obama as an incumbent president should be elected handily by a wide margin and wider than 4 years ago, but that will not be the case primarily because of the economy and for other reasons that I talked about, that the Republicans will lose a few seats in the House of Representatives but retain control of the House, and that the Republicans will win control of the U.S. Senate. And I think that was sort of the nutshell. I mean, what's more significant is why I think those things are going to occur, but those were the predictions, the fearless predictions that I offer. And as a college professor, I can do that because if I'm wrong, nobody's going to remember. So, right.
Oh,
well,
but some of us will.
First of all, we all will. when I read your predictions, I'm not meaning this as a criticism. I'm looking for an explanation, I guess. You call them fearless.
No,
but in reality, fearless,
no.
Barbara did. But in reality, they're in the norm right now. This is what most people are predicting.
Well,
do you see anything, with Romney, with the House, very moderate predictions, Obama's going to be reelected just by this much. Do you see anything in the future that might change that? I mean, we all can know that there can be an October surprise. We know what the wrong vice presidential choice can do for a Republican candidate, but do you see anything that could change that? Because right now, this is really what everybody's saying.
Well, I'm not sure I agree that those are sort of... I agree that I don't think there's anything startling in these mm-hmm. sort of predictions. Anytime you have two candidates or more on the ballot, anything can happen. Certainly circumstances could arise. The economy could worsen, for example, and that would be terrible for Obama. Because there is a strong correlation between certain economic indicators and the outcomes of presidential elections. Although I will add that on the unemployment rate, although it's a serious problem, is not correlated with election outcomes at the national level. It is not a predictor. That doesn't mean it's not important. But in terms of election day statistics, the unemployment rate is not correlated with the outcome of presidential races. There certainly are wild cards that could occur, a crisis in foreign policy, an attack on American soil, change in the economy. I mean, lots of things could happen, but I just think other things being equal, those are the likely outcomes. And you're right, they're not startling by any means.
Other reactions?
I would only add that the world is in such bad shape that the chances of very dramatic things happening between now and November are very high. They could either be economic or they could be related to national security. And depending on how the president deals with them, it will have a lot to say about who wins. I agree with you that Romney looks like he would be the nominee because he is already a centrist and he isn't going to have to move there, whereas the others would. As far as I can tell, Kaine, Bachman, Perry, and Santorum, for different reasons, are all now dead. And I never thought I'd say this a month ago, but I think Newt Gingrich is hanging around. And he's a clever guy, and he can get money, and he might end up as the last Republican challenging Romney. I respect mm-hmm. Paul for having the only coherent philosophy in the campaign. Whether you agree with all...
On either side.
Whether you agree with it or not, at least I understand where he's coming from, and he is predictable, and I think that's valuable. And Huntsman is clearly the most qualified, but he seems to be unable to get media attention. Here I blame the press. But I would say Gingrich or Romney would be my guess. And if either of them can beat Obama, it would be dependent entirely on this crazy world we're in.
Did you?
I mean, the euro may be gone by then. Europe may have unraveled. The whole European Union's finished. What's that going to do to our own economy? We don't know. None of this is transparent.
Did you hear on Leno last night that he said that in the most recent poll, Huntsman polled 0%, which means he's not even voting for himself?
Lisa or Tara, any quick reactions?
No, I agree with everything that's been said.
All right, time to open the grade book then. A's and F's, and we're going to start with F's. And David,
all right,
we will start with you.
My F to Governor Cuomo and the state legislature for the mandate that all New York health insurance companies in New York State cover autism screening and treatment. Now, before you throw things at me, this is not because I have any particular brief against treating autism, but this is an example of the kinds of mandates that New York State puts on health insurance that increase the cost of health care in New York State for everybody, because these costs then get put into the average premium. A Harvard study says that the average cost of treating autism is between $67,000 and $72,000 a year. And New York State has 50 of these kinds of mandates now, and this has led to why premiums in New York State are twice the national average. We're going to have a debate in this country very shortly about what it means to be an essential health benefit. And that is what's going to determine what the national health bill, if it stays alive, is going to ensure. This relates directly to that debate. And people are going to have to sit down and decide what exactly are we going to ensure in this country and at what level. And it seemed to me that for the governor and the legislature at this point in history to approve this mandate at this cost, to me, makes no sense.
Lisa.
Speaking of health care, my F has to go to the Ohio voters, 60% of them who approved this bizarre constitutional amendment to the Ohio Constitution relating that would reflects on the Obama mandate or the Affordable Care Act mandate. Basically says that no law shall require anyone to buy health insurance, but it also says a lot of other things. It's symbolic. The sad thing is it's symbolic purely in terms of its a potential to affect the actual federal mandate, but it has the potential to really wreak havoc with actual health care policy in the state of Ohio in ways and have all kinds of terrible unintended consequences. But again, I think it is a reaction to concerns about overreach.
This is from the Department of Shooting Fish in a Barrel. My app is to Joe Paterno, the athletic hierarchy, and the Board of Trustees down at Happy Valley. No matter how much money you have, no matter how many wins you have, no matter how much influence you have, if you turn a blind eye to the needs of a child, you are nobody.
I'm giving my F to Judge Kenneth Schluger of the Connecticut State Court System. He recently ordered a divorced couple to exchange, via their lawyers, Facebook passwords. In this case, Stephen Galleon's attorney requested Courtney Galleon's Facebook password because he felt it would provide information helpful to his custody case. Judge Schluger is not the first judge to recognize a limited right to do this, yet there didn't seem to be a whole lot of concern for the information to which Galleon's attorney would have access.
And I'm giving an F to the student riot that took place last night in support of sexual abuse at Penn State. Now, it wasn't literally in support of sexual abuse, but they were rioting because Joe Paterno had been fired by the Board of Trustees. But the whole point is that Paterno had this information, knew about it for years. Neither he nor his staff reported it to police authorities for action to be taken. It was serious, serial sexual abuse, and the grand jury report is available online to read. It's eye-opening reading. But if the students don't understand that if you have knowledge of a serious felony and you don't do anything about it, that implicates you in the crime as well. And I'm appalled at the student rioting that occurred last night by those students.
My F back to elections goes to the two major parties in Syracuse, principally the Democrats, who have the majority, in the lack of recruitment and development of persons of color to run for the school board. We have a predominantly minority school board, and we have a significantly majority now white board with only one person of color. I wish I had the TV audience so I could tell you to hurry up. So let's move quickly on our A's here.
We can ignore you with or without a camera.
So we can get to questions.
I'm going to rehabilitate my First Amendment credentials with Lisa. My A goes to the U.S. District Court Judge Neil McKern, who said that the state of New York violated First Amendment rights when they said that a group could not sell a license plate that had on it the message "Choose Life," which was to encourage adoption. The state took the position that such a license plate would lead to road rage if people saw it. Well, this is absurd. What the state is doing was deciding we don't like that message, and therefore we're not going to let you put that message on a license plate, but we would let you put "I support the Yankees" on a license plate. Government can't do that.
Yeah, that'll lead to road rage.
Government can't do that, and the judge was right to say that you've got to let them sell that license plate.
Well, you are so correct, David. So you have gone a long way toward rehabilitating yourself, but unless and until you pull back that absurd proposal that we compel people to go to the polls, you will not be fully rehabilitated. My A was going to be to the voters of Arizona for recalling the state senator who had authored and sponsored the immigration thing, because that's an important issue to me. But I will instead give my A actually to the Penn State Board of Trustees, who I thought actually acted perfectly appropriately in every respect. They gave Joe Paterno a chance to do what he should have done. When he didn't, they did it for him. They did it at a reasonable rate of speed. They did it unanimously. The gentleman who spoke last night in terms of defending it, I just stood there and thought, gosh, if we could have this kind of leadership generally, we would be, the world would be a much better place. But I have to join what Bob Spitzer said about those students, because not only did they riot last night, the night before they were at Paterno's house, and early yesterday morning when I heard that students had gone to Joe Paterno's house, I thought, oh my gosh, they must have set the place on fire. You know, I thought they must be there to complain, to protest Joe Paterno. And when I realized that they were there to support him, I just couldn't believe my ears. So I think it really says something. And obviously, it's a small minority of the 95,000 students of the Pennsylvania State University, but it's really shocking, and I think it says something about, you know, what kind of people we're educating and the sort of psychic health of students, who I think get a little bit too much credit in terms of knowing what they're doing.
I disagree with you on the Board of Trustees. They knew 20 years ago they should have fired him then. I do agree with David on one thing. The world is a very unhappy place. So things that consistently make us smile, I think, deserve notice. I learned this morning with most of you that the creator of my all-time favorite comic strip, Bill Keane of the Family Circle, he died yesterday. His family-based humor was something that not all humor is today, if you want to call it humor today. It was very gentle. And while his son had took over the strip 2 years ago, we don't have that kind of gentle humor that makes us happy anymore. The definition of humor seems to be what polarizes us and makes us mad at each other. So Keane's approach to humor will be missed.
I'm giving my A to the 26% of voters who did turn out to vote yesterday, or on Tuesday. And I'm giving them that A for this reason. It means that they take their citizenship seriously, and that's very, very important.
And I'm giving an A to my hometown newspaper, the Cortland Standard. It's a paper where the reporters pretty much tend to report the transcripts of local meetings and the police blotter. But they did some real investigation about two candidates that ran for city council in the city, two landlords who were trying to advance their personal agendas. Neither of them live in the city, but they set up kind of a sham residence in the city so they could claim to run from the wards for city council. And by gosh, the reporters actually went to the house, knocked on the door, they interviewed people, they actually did some real digging on this story, and it was nice to see them going out and doing, I mean, it's not the New York Times, but doing some real investigative reporting. So an A to the Cortland Standard.
Always like it when journalists get A's. I had the opportunity to take students to the Onondaga County Board of Elections this past week as preparation for their covering the elections, and I never realized all the work, all the 36 different ballots and getting it all. And, you know, I walked in, and I hope all of you did, and voted easily on those new machines that have been around for a couple of years. And I think we overlook the amount of work that the Board of Elections does. So my A to Ed Ryan and Pinky Kiggins-Walsh for conducting elections that were fair and easy to vote and successful. It's usually my time to say thank you for watching, but I don't have to do that. Sandy, we haven't left you as much time as I had hoped, but I think we've got 15 minutes for questions, and we'd be glad to.
We'll squeeze in a few questions. That's great. Thank you very much. Thanks to all. Actually, I want to, and we'll see you again tomorrow night. That's the beauty of this. I want to pick up on something on your A, Barb, and also David's very controversial proposal for forcing people to vote. Aside from, in order to increase voter turnout, we've often read that it would behoove us to try to make voting easier. As you say, it is easy, but we still have some restrictions. Back a few years ago when the Onondaga Citizens League did a study, one of the things that we found is if people could register up to an election, when interest is really peaked, because that's when your mailbox is really full of the stuff, and you say, oh yeah, you know, I need to vote in this election, but I'm not registered, maybe I moved, I'm in a different district. So that was one thing. But something else I read recently, and I'd like you to comment on, is why don't we let people vote where they are? And in Onondaga County, the first two places that come to mind are, I don't know, Wegmans and Carousel Center or something, you know. But given the technology today and the ability, I would guess, to have a database of voters in Onondaga County, why not let somebody vote after work when they're going grocery shopping? Or, you know, maybe there's a place downtown where people are, where people work, or at the university, without having to find the dark, dreary church basement. That's your ward. Go ahead.
I would actually solve it this way. Vote on Sunday. Why are we voting on Tuesdays? Mm-hmm. So vote on Sunday, or vote Saturday and Sunday.
Right, if, have multi-day voting.
Right.
There are many comparisons. There have been many comparisons between voting practices in the United States and voting rules versus other democratic nations, leaving aside mandatory voting as one option. And America makes it more difficult for people to vote than most any other democratic nation in terms of the rules and regulations. We vote in the middle of the week, not on the weekend. Virtually every other democratic nation holds its elections on the weekend. We don't allocate enough resources to have enough polling places. There's no reason to have lengthy lines where people have to stand for hours to vote. That happens because there aren't enough polling places. There aren't enough machines. Duh. It's not rocket science. It's real simple, but we don't devote enough resources to make it easier. And that's just bad policy to me.
Same-day voting?
That occurs in the state of Maine. In fact, there was a referendum because Maine moved and eliminated same-day registration and voting, and the voters reinstituted it. They've done it for four decades in Maine, and I think North Dakota does it too. That would be another way that would make voting easier, sure.
To get back to your comment, though, I think part of the reason that you know, certainly as we use technology, perhaps you could find a way to ensure that there were no glitches with the voting if people did it from their phone or what have you. But I think that's part of the reason that they do have a very specific designated place where you can go vote, is so that you have people there who can ensure that if there's a problem, they can respond hopefully quickly and you can go ahead and vote. Because, you know, what if that day your phone happens to go out, or what if that day the power goes out in Wegmans? What do you do then? So I think that's the reason why.
Okay, thank you. You had a question?
2 weeks ago, Onondaga County Republican Chairman Tom Dady made it known that Mayor Stephanie Miner had made a $45,000 contribution to the New York State Democratic Committee, which was later distributed to four candidates, I believe, in Syracuse and Onondaga County. Your thoughts?
I don't know exactly what the law says. There was a parallel circumstance in Texas a few years ago where Tom DeLay, the former Republican leader in the House, did this funneling money to the Republican National Committee and then back to candidates, and that was a violation of federal election law, and he's still under indictment, I think, for that. I don't know what the law reads on that. If it was an actual violation, they did return the money, but if it was illegal, then she should be subject to the prosecution under state law.
She claims it is not.
Right.
She can give money to the party. She can make suggestions to the party. The party decides what to do with the money. I mean, I haven't looked at the law. I don't know.
Yeah. And I guess the end product of that is that it didn't affect the election in the way that a lot of people thought that it would. It was able to be spun as negative campaigning and other things that Masterpol used to his benefit in the last moments of that election.
One quick thought. Given the Citizens United case and the amount of money flooding in from corporations and other groups, the kind of money you're talking about here and what the parties can do is so minuscule that we're worrying about the wrong thing.
Hi, Lisa, First Amendment review. I wonder if on David's proposal there was something on the ballot that just merely said, I'm here, but I don't want to vote, and gave somebody, would that pass First Amendment and therefore let David's proposal go through?
None of the above.
Yeah, I mean, I've never even, until this morning, I've never even heard of or thought about such a thing. But
you stick with me, kiddo.
David always surprises me with the things he comes up with. My gut tells me that's going to go down no matter what. You're not going to be able to compel people to even go to the polling places. But I don't even know where the power of the government, what portion of the Constitution we would locate the government's power to do that in.
I teach a course every 4 years in voting rights for the students. They come to the conclusion that they should have the right to cast a negative vote instead of a positive vote, and that they should have the opportunity to check none of the above. And one of the reasons, according to the students, and I think there's some validity to this, that people don't vote is because they don't have the opportunity to vote negatively against all candidates. They're all, so what they do is they stay home. Now, whether or not that solves the issue, we get a number of people coming out and going, none of the above. My answer to my students is, what if none of the above wins? Then what do?
You rerun the election.
Rerun the election, and it costs money.
The state of Nevada allows that sort of voting, and whoever gets the most votes still wins. I'm not a supporter of none of the above. I think it's dumb. If you want to, you can go to the polls, register, sign the form, and not mark candidates. So you are enrolled, you're somebody who is on the books as having come to the polling place, but you don't have to vote for any of the candidates.
Last year, the Board of Elections made what we consider a very bad change in the 17th Ward. There were people, approximately 89, are registered voters in what used to be the old Charles Andrews School. They used to vote in their building. Starting last year, they were forced to vote either absentee or roll themselves down to Hillside. I think it diminished the participation. Actually, I would like to see some sort of regulation by the state that you absolutely cannot change voting places which are dominantly for older people and move them someplace else. We thought it might be to diminish the participation in one of the parties, but we had six absentee ballots and not very many more people come in. It was outrageous because they used to come down on the elevator and vote.
I think that goes to Bob Spitzer's point about how little we fund elections. I mean, they have cut down the polling places. Ed Ryan told my students that, and it's because they don't get enough money from the legislature to run these elections. So we give them more money.
I think it's also difficult, I don't know if Ed could weigh in on this, but to find volunteers to sit at the polls for 15 hours, and that may be another thing to change the way that poll watchers have to be.
A lot of students trained to do that because they're pretty savvy with the computers, so they could certainly increase that option.
I'm concerned about the issue of voting for judges in this state. I come from the day when conservative meant that you were fiscally a tightwad, where today I think conservative means that you care what happens in other people's bedrooms. And so when it comes to voting for judges, I don't even, judges can't say anything other than perhaps their name and what law school they went to. And so you've got these labels which change every 5 years without a definition in writing about what those labels mean, and yet you're supposed to ask me to vote for them, and I find it a very confusing issue.
Furthermore, an extremist would say that those labels shouldn't matter when it comes to judges. So that's the last basis we should be elected. I'm totally opposed to judicial elections. So, I mean, I'm with you for your reasons and so many other reasons. But that's our system in New York, and it's the system in several states. And I understand the arguments in favor of it, and I just don't think we ought to do it. But I also, if we're going to do it, then I'm not a fan of allowing judges to go out and say, obviously not, if you vote for me, I'll do this, right? I mean, that's just, it's completely antithetical to political campaigning. I'm completely opposed to it.
Well, I'm not opposed to electing judges, but because I've thought about this a little bit, but what I think we should have is that there should be a set sort of piece of information that you can get about a judge, and basically it should be their case record. If you've been a judge before, okay, you can simply put out there what your case record is, what your decisions were, that's it. If you haven't been a judge before, then you simply put out, okay, in these subject areas, the law says, and you give your interpretation of the law, and that's it. So you don't know party affiliation, they can't tell you party affiliation, and then you vote on them, because then you're voting on what they're going to be actually doing.
I think that the cure is worse than the disease. I think that I understand the point that you're making, and there's a lot of validity to it, but the flip side is if we leave all our judicial choices, particularly those with good behavior, life tenure, up to politicians to choose, I think that's worse than a bad voting system.
Well, but that's who chooses our life tenure judges, mm-hmm. politicians. But there's a middle ground, which is some sort of, and I know David's going to scoff at this, but some sort of commission or, evaluation system that
you
has...
By the ABA?
No, the ABA has no power to put judges it just evaluates judges. We have judicial evaluation around here, but again, I think we have to worry about the political nature of that. But there's a way in between a pure political appointment. I'm not out here saying that political appointing of judges is the solution either. Okay, I've got big concerns about that, and I don't think enough is said about the fact that appointed judges get some of them anyway, through the political process, obviously, too.
We have changed things in New York. New York State's highest court is the Court of Appeals, and those judges used to all be elected. They would run for election. And I think it was in the 1970s when that was converted to nomination by the governor, ratification by the state Senate. So we've made that much of a change occurred in New York State, and mm-hmm. you could certainly do that for other judicial levels, too.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on the low voter turnout. Is it in any way influenced by the educational system?
Absolutely. I tie low voter turnout, and there's actually some data to suggest this, to the level of literacy and the level of civic education in this country. I would put it even more simply. Nobody reads newspapers anymore, and it is... That level, that distance from civic education is also a distance from the interest in voting.
Well, the degree of turnout is directly related to age. The older, and this has historically been true, the older you are, the more likely you are to vote. It's also strongly correlated with level of education. People with more education tend to vote more than people with less education. In terms of the existing younger age cohorts, people in college, we still make it fairly difficult for them to vote. And I think if voting matters, and I think it does, it has to matter for the reasons that David and Lisa have been alluding to, that is, it's the first job of the citizen. It's the job of the citizen to vote, even whether it's mandated or not. And the best way to inculcate that habit is to begin early, and you turn 18 when you go to college or, you're in the work world, and we could certainly do more to encourage our students to vote, because the habit, if it's going to occur, will be more effective if it begins early.
I have another proposal about why there might have been such a low voter turnout. Perhaps another 10% showed up at the polls and found it very difficult to vote. I was one of the ones who went. First, you have to find a pen that works. Then you go to this table that shakes. Then you have to take off your glasses. Then you have to try to fill in these circles properly. You know, I understand that there were problems with voting machines, with the old levers, losing some of the votes. But can't we come up with a better system? I mean, see if this is very straight. It took 20 minutes.
It takes a long time.
Well, the voting system, the old lever machines were reliable. The problem was that they stopped manufacturing them. You couldn't get parts. I kind of like the old lever machines too, so I'm with you on that. Then touch screens became very common. That was the new technology. The problem was that there was no paper trail. And the one great virtue of the system that I think we all now use is that you fill out that large piece of paper and you slide it in the machine. And if you have a recount and need to do a recount, you have a piece of paper that shows how the person voted. And that is, to me, nearly indispensable. I agree that it's a bit of a confusing. When I took my mother to vote last year, she was confused about what it was you were supposed to, circle, and I was able to help her. The ballot could be designed in a more friendly way. I think that wouldn't be very complicated. Again, it goes to the fact that little thought and little sort of analysis goes to the process of what an easy-to-use ballot looks like. But I think that could be tweaked if there was any motivation to do it, to make it a little easier.
Okay, a time for one quick question.
The legislature has been dealing with a piece of legislation that never has gotten anywhere, and that would be to limit a candidate to be a registered in that party, so there would be no cross endorsements. Now, that would be a way to get more people on the ballot from that particular party, and you would have more of an identification of what that person stood for, because of course they would be identified with their party. How do you feel about opening up the ballot to no cross endorsements?
I've written and researched on the cross endorsement system in New York. It's almost unique, but I like the cross endorsement system because it allows small parties to survive, and they tend to be ideological parties, you know, based on abortion, or the Working Families Party, that's a more liberal party. And I actually think it's a good thing for the system. There are some consequences of it that people don't like, but I like the cross-endorsement system because it has a certain energizing effect on the ballot, although I understand that there are arguments against.
All right. Well, I would like to, before I thank the panelists again, thank all of the people who did, in addition to the voters who did go out, the people who put themselves out and campaigned and put themselves on the ballot. And we happen to have a few of them here, including a couple who won. So congratulations to them. And we're going to be watching you. So, and again, thanks to the Ivory Tower, our panel. And we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow night on WCNY.